the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thank you for downloading the very latest podcast from peterbcollins.com. In a moment, we'll start talking with Professor Stephen Boyd. He teaches religion at Wake Forest University. And North Carolina is one of many states where Republican-controlled legislatures with Republican governors are trying to turn back the clock and roll back voting rights and abortion rights in breathtaking ways. And as you've heard me critique, I don't see an equivalent response from the Democrats on voting rights that affect their very political future and on abortion rights, which have been a central plank of Democratic platforms. In North Carolina, they're not waiting for the Democrats to come to the rescue. Every Monday now, people are protesting under what are called Moral Mondays. Professor Boyd's got the lowdown coming right up here on the Peter B. Collins Show. As you may know, there are two ways you can support our efforts. You can subscribe, and people do, like Aaron Blair, Mark Sosnick, Raymond Welch, and Mark Brodsky. I'm grateful to those individuals, and you can do it too. All the information is right under my mugshot on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. The other way you can support us is by doing business with GoDaddy.com. They're one of the leaders in low-cost domain name registration and web hosting, and they have excellent customer service. I know, because I've been working with GoDaddy for over 10 years now. And if you sign up today for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, starting as low as $1.99 a month, you'll get your domain name free. And to get a special deal that supports the Peter B. Collins Show, follow the GoDaddy link in the show file for this podcast, and you'll get an extra $5 off your purchase of $30 or more. Again, that link is at the top of the show file related to this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Here's that long-haired, freaky, right-wing country rock singer, Charlie Daniels, to threaten us. Yeah, the South is doing it again. You got your Texas, you got your Alabama, and now North Carolina, where voter suppression and abortion rights, abortion right rollbacks, are the theme of the day.
People down in Florida can't be still when Leonard Skinner's picking down in Jacksonville. People down in Georgia come from near and far to hear Richard Best picking on that red guitar. So get around. Gather round, chill and be down. But just get down, chill and get loud. Well, you can be loud, yeah, and be proud. And you can be proud, yeah, and I'll be proud. Whatever, cause the South's gonna do it again.
The South is doing it, and, well, the North is doing it as well. We have Michigan and Wisconsin, where we've seen rollbacks in many, on many fronts, including abortion rights, these voter suppression tactics that come from boilerplate legislation, and other issues as well. And North Carolina seems to be a current epicenter of right-wing reaction, and they are ramming bills through the legislature faster than Who Shot Bob. So to get some commentary, I called my friend David Coates at Wake Forest University, and he said the go-to guy on this is Stephen Boyd. He is a professor of religion at Wake Forest, and he has been active in the protests against the right-wing legislative maneuvers there in the Tar Heel State. Professor Boyd, welcome to our program today.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's good to be with you.
And are you a longtime resident of North Carolina, maybe born and raised?
I was not. I was born and raised in Tennessee, about 3 hours from here, Upper East Tennessee, where Charlie Daniels is from.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to school in the north, and then I returned to teach at Wake Forest University in 1985. So I've been here for 28 years.
Okay.
So it feels like home. It's really, you know, only 3 hours away is where I grew up.
Now, we think of North Carolina as a generally conservative state with a lot of what we call blue dots, progressive pockets, including in your area. But we've seen the forces of reaction really take charge, and in recent weeks it has culminated in a 12-pack of voter suppression measures,
right,
and also a bill that was nominally about motorcycle safety, which
right,
includes all of the this pattern of abortion rights rollbacks,
right,
that we've seen in Ohio, Wisconsin, Texas, and it's bubbling up in other places.
Right.
So set the stage for us. You sent me an article from Jane Mayer in The New Yorker that was
right,
published last year,
right,
that exposes Art Pope, who is the godfather of Republican politics in North Carolina.
Yeah.
And the article doesn't directly relate to the election of your new Republican governor, Pat McCrory, but I imagine Art Pope had a role in that. So give us the landscape there, if you would.
Well, I don't know how far you want to draw back the line, but let me just say quickly, in terms of North Carolina in the context of Southern politics, you know, after the Civil War and Reconstruction in late 1870s, when federal troops were withdrawn, the Democratic Party basically, which was not the party of emancipation, but resisted emancipation, sort of took over and orchestrated a coup of the legislature and many city councils in North Carolina, and it was the party that ushered in Jim Crow. And
mm-hmm,
through the 20th century, the Democrats were the ones in control. They have been in control of the legislature since that coup in the late 1870s until recently. Now, as you know, Southern politics have changed, as national politics have, and the parties have kind of reversed philosophies. And the Democratic Party in the 60s and 70s became the party for human rights, civil rights, the rights of women, et cetera. And during the Reagan administration, a number of Democrats that we call in the state Yellow Dog Democrats, that is, Democrats who really share what came to be a Republican fiscal and social policy, switched parties under Reagan. So in the 80s and 90s, a large number of folks went to the Republican Party, but still, even today, Democrats out-register. The Democratic Party has like 2.1 million registered voters, 2.7 million registered voters, as opposed to 1.9 Republicans.
Really?
Yes, but many of the people in the Democratic Party are still socially and fiscally conservative. So to bring us up to the current and Mayer's article in The New Yorker, we're not the only state that has very conservative, ideologically conservative activists. And the most important one in our state is Art Pope.
Mm-hmm.
He is related to the Koch brothers. He goes to American Legislative Exchange Council.
Yeah.
He goes to their meetings each week, each year. He's been on their board of trustees, and he served in the early 90s in the legislature. He's a North Carolina native. He was born and raised here. His father was a friend of Jesse Helms.
You forgot the mega bucks.
Pardon me?
You forgot his mega bucks.
I'm getting there.
Okay.
So the holding company that he inherited and now presides over is called Variety Inc., I believe it is, and it's a holding company that includes either Dollar General or Family Dollar Store, Roses, Maxway, and I think the family fortune is like $150 million, and he has spent that liberally.
Mm-hmm.
In the last, I would say from 2005 to the present, for about 8 years. The most significant change was in 2010. It was a concerted effort to identify particular districts in the State House and Senate, and he poured something like $40 million into, not personally, there are various ways, he has various not-for-profit entities through which he gives to candidates, and then since Citizens United decision, corporate entities who run ads and target it at Democratic candidates. So the upshot of it is, in 2008, the Democrats, as they had for over 100 years, continued to have a majority both in the House and the Senate, a slim majority, but a majority.
Mm-hmm.
2010, that for the first time in over 100 years flipped. The Republicans won both the House and the Senate in 2010. Bev Perdue had won during the 2008 general election when Obama took North Carolina by a very slim margin, the first mm-hmm. Democrat to do so since Jimmy Carter in 1976.
Right.
Bev Perdue was a Democrat, and so from after 2010, there was a kind of a check and a balance, and that is they didn't have a supermajority, and the Republicans didn't have a supermajority, so there are only so many bills they could pass, and there are only so many bills that Democrats would join them in overriding vetoes, and Bev Perdue vetoed a number of bills that they were not able to override. In 2012, you might want to say that the dam broke, if you're speaking from the Democratic side, and that is they won supermajorities. The Republicans won supermajorities in the House and Senate and also the governor's mansion with Pat McCrory.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, one of the people who served on the board of one of Art Pope's foundations was McCrory's campaign manager in 2008 when he failed, but it has been a close advisor in 2012 when he was successful in achieving the governor's mansion. And shortly after he was inaugurated, Governor McCrory made Art Pope the director of the budget.
Mm, nice payback.
Pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Pretty sweet.
Now,
so
Art
one
Pope...
One of the comments I would just make in terms of that larger picture you asked me to draw is that... Justice Ginsburg, when the Citizens United decision came down, warned that precisely this kind of pay-to-play politics would happen all over America, and we are Exhibit A of what money can do in electoral politics.
And Jane Mayer depicts the money that Art Pope spends as propelling some of the dirtiest, most scurrilous campaign lies that, I mean, when you read her New Yorker article,
right.
it's pretty astounding what Pope will do with a TV commercial that just destroys the reputation of an opponent. And it's completely fact-free.
It is fact-free. Don't bother me. It's a fact. But what's also interesting about that is that he not only goes after Democrats, he goes after Republicans who do not adhere rigidly enough to the legislative agenda. And a good example of that is Morgan, who was the House Speaker, who Art Pope went after and defeated. Not the first time, but the second time he defeated Morgan, who is a moderate Republican. So there's a kind of party discipline that is pretty frightening in this state.
Mm-hmm.
When we had, and you'll probably want to talk about this, the voter ID bill went through. I listened to that online, and Democrat after Democrat got up to talk about a grandmother, a mother, a grandfather who had fought in the civil rights era for voting rights, et cetera, and were just appealing to the Republicans not to pass this bill. And by the vote, nobody changed their mind mm-hmm. on the Republican side of the aisle. And so they were speaking to a stone wall. And that's not a surprise, because if I were a Republican running for state House or state Senate in North Carolina, I would not want that Polk machine directed at me in a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just about against Democrats. It's also Republicans who step the least bit out of line on what the agenda is.
Well, Grover Norquist has imposed that kind of discipline where state legislators who vote for any tax increase are taken out and virtually shot at the
right.
next election. Sometimes they'll even do recalls or special elections to impose that kind of discipline. Now, on this program, Professor, we talk a lot about election integrity issues and the suppression tactics that have been in play the last two cycles. And I want to just briefly recap for our listeners the array. There are actually 12 different elements here of the voter suppression bill that was passed with the spin on it that this is a way to clean up elections, make sure that only, registered voters vote. So
right.
it eliminated pre-registration for high school students.
Right.
It outlawed paid voter registration drives. It
right.
eliminates straight ticket voting, and I don't actually have a big problem with that. Eliminates provisional voting if somebody shows up at the wrong precinct. It prohibits counties from extending poll hours by an hour if there are lines at the polls. It's just we're closing and you're out of luck. It allows any registered voter of a county to challenge the eligibility of a voter rather than just a voter of the precinct in which the suspect voter is registered. That allows people to float around and make multiple challenges. It moves the presidential primary to the first Tuesday after South Carolina's primary. And it changes the language. Instead of mandating electronic filing for campaign returns, it proposes to study it, which is like downgrading a hurricane to a little drizzle. It'll increase the campaign contribution limit up to $5,000 from $4,000. It loosens disclosure requirements in campaign ads by people like Art Pope. It repeals the publicly funded election program for appellate court justices. And finally, it repeals the requirement that candidates endorse ads that are run by their campaigns. So in the guise, under the guise of cleaning up elections and, making sure that only the right people vote, what will be the impact here? How many North Carolinians have to rush out and get a photo ID before the next election?
Oh, my gosh. Let me answer that last question first. About 500,000 people will need mm-hmm. to rush out. Anywhere between 300,000 and 500,000 people will have to rush out and get an ID.
All right, so if we use your higher number, that would reduce Democratic potential turnout to 2.2 million, which with the Republican registration of 1.9 million, that kind of brings things into an artificially leveled playing field.
Yes. Well, that's just one thing. Of the many things you mentioned, let me just say a couple things from where I see them on the ground here. First of all, this was a voter integrity bill, is what the Republican majority called it. Another group, and so the argument was that we have a perception that there's fraud and that people are voting fraudulently in our state. Well, you'd be interested to know, and your listeners would be interested to know, that of 21 million North Carolinians who have voted in the past 12 years, we've had one case of voter fraud. One case. 21 million people. I can't even calculate that percentage.
Mm-hmm.
So that's clearly not what this bill is about.
And let's put it in context, because This has occurred following the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision, which overturned the portion of the Voting Rights Act that required states like North Carolina to get prior approval from the Justice Department before they could make these kind of changes in voting procedures. And Texas was first out of the gate. I think they only waited 12 hours to impose the photo ID requirement. And you slackers in North Carolina took, what, 3 weeks? Maybe even a month?
Well, this... Well, I'll say this. The effect of Shelby, the Supreme Court decision on us, is that there was a House version of this voter rights bill, or voter ID bill is kind of what it's called here in North Carolina, that came out earlier in the spring. It was composed of 16 pages. Not all of those things that you mentioned were in that bill. It passed. Four Democrats voted for it in the House before it went to the Senate. Between when it went to the Senate and came back from the Senate, you had the Shelby decision, and then the bill became 54 pages long and had this laundry list. In fact, the governor was asked the day before he, well, the day he announced he was going to sign this bill, the governor, Governor McCrory, was asked, well, what about the provision that young high school students cannot register early so that if they turn 18 just days before the election, they can vote? That's always been a great high school civics project. Mr. McCrory, Governor McCrory, looked at the reporter and said, I don't know anything about that. I haven't read that part of the bill. He'd already announced he was going to sign it. Now, you tell me what's going on here. Folks are on orders. And it is the weirdest, strangest feeling to think that you've got people in lockstep in our legislature who are taking orders, you know, who are writing these, basically taking these model bills coming from ALEC, and when they can get away with it, in this case, the voter ID bill, after the Supreme Court decision came down, they can just put the whole laundry list back in that, and I am convinced that not many of the legislators had read the whole 54-page bill when it came back from conference to reconcile those two bills, and the Senate version was adopted and passed 73-41. And it cuts a full, let me just say a couple things. It cuts a full week off of early voting. It goes from 17 days to 10 days. That's 56% of the electorate in North Carolina that vote early voting, okay? It eliminates same-day voter registration during early voting. That's 155,000 people who did that in 2012. A lot of those are college students. The other thing is that you can't use a college ID, even a state. If you go to Universal of University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, you can't use your Chapel Hill ID to vote. You've got to use a driver's license, or you've got to get a different kind of ID, a birth certificate, et cetera.
And isn't even if I have it right that it's North Carolina, there's a clause that says that if a student votes in the wrong precinct, the parents have to pay a fine?
No, if the you've got that almost right.
Okay.
If a student does not vote in the student's home precinct,
I see,
the parents cannot claim them as dependents on their taxes.
Okay.
So it's a poll tax. Just like the voter ID that you have to pay for if you don't have one, and you'd be interested to know, African Americans, who are only 22% of the voting population, make up 32% of the voters without the photo ID that's going to be required. Of seniors, who make up 18% of the population, 26% of seniors don't have the valid photo ID. Women, who are 54% of the population, make up 66% of the active voters that don't have the valid North Carolina ID. African Americans, seniors, those are the people who are being disenfranchised.
Now, do you have any proof that ALEC legislation is part of this big package that passed in North Carolina?
It has been the model for other bills. I did not go online. That was one of the things I was going to do before I came to talk to you today. I was going to go online and look at the model legislation. You know, there's a website you can go and look at the model legislation. I was going to go on there and compare this bill to the ALEC bill, but I didn't have time to do that.
Okay.
So it would be interesting for a listener to do that. It'd be a nice research project for one of my students.
Yeah, I'd be very curious to see a kind of line-by-line comparison. Now, the other front that Republicans have a coordinated effort on is to roll back women's health rights, reproductive rights, up to and including abortion rights.
Right.
And as a professor of religion, I certainly respect that you may not be a full-throated pro-choice person. I don't presume anything. But this is a very pernicious process that is underway. Because it's very clear through the pattern, Texas, Wisconsin, Ohio, North Carolina, and other states, that this is a very coordinated, concerted effort, and it thumbs its nose at the Supreme Court's Roe versus Wade decision. It's clearly angling for an appeal to the Supreme Court to try to overturn Roe. But in the meantime, they are putting these phony restrictions, such as, an abortion doctor has to have privileges at a nearby hospital, and the hallway has to be 16 feet wide. And all these kinds of ridiculous conditions are being imposed in order to shut down clinics, and not just abortion clinics, but also those that provide contraception.
Right.
And so this is bad enough on the face of it, but they used the gut and amend procedure, which is not unique to North Carolina, where you take a bill that's gone through committees, it's gotten out on the floor, and it's moving along, and you either strip out the existing provisions or you just jam in others and ram it through. And that's what they did on a motorcycle safety law.
Right.
They saddled it with all of these restrictions on abortion and reproductive rights.
Right.
So talk a little bit about that process and the extent to which it might have been coordinated with ALEC.
Oh, of course it was. Of course. This is a plan, you know. That's my assumption. You'd have to do the research to demonstrate that. But it's so very similar to other restrictions that are being introduced in other legislation across the country that certainly folks in our state didn't make this up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the first time it was introduced in the spring, it was the Family, Faith, and Freedom Act, and originally, the act was to prohibit Sharia law ever being legislated in North Carolina.
Right.
And then they abandoned that vehicle and, as you said, tacked it onto a motorcycle safety bill. Now, what logic does that make? The rhetoric is they want to protect women's health. These clinics that provide abortion procedures are not meeting standards that we would want any medical clinic to meet. For example, the clinics now that offer abortion services are going to be regulated like outpatient surgical centers. That means that of the 17 clinics that offer abortion procedures, 16 will have to close.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Governor McCrory, when he was asked during the campaign in one of the debates, Governor, how many restrictions on abortion would you introduce when you're governor? His answer was none. That was his promise.
Well, and apparently the governor doesn't know about YouTube, because I've seen the clip of that debate answer that he gave. And it was one of those cases where, you know how Joe Biden occasionally shocks people by giving a one-word answer?
Yeah.
Well, that's what McCrory did.
And, he did.
And he refused to elaborate. And so there was no wiggle room. There was no if and or but appended to it. It was simply none.
Right. Well, and so when it first came from the House, he was unhappy, and he said publicly that, you know, I have promised not to restrict abortion, so this bill needs to be changed. What they did was they put language in the bill at one point in the bill that said without unduly restricting women's access to abortion. Didn't change any other part of the bill. Just put without unduly restricting women's access to abortion. And I guess that meant that the governor could sign it because it had that language in it. Now, does the rest of the bill actually unduly restrict women's access to abortion? Yes, it does. It's so transparent. The disingenuity is so transparent, and that's what we're dealing with here in North Carolina. Under the guise of protecting women's health, 16 of 17 clinics are going to be closed.
Mm-hmm.
In North Carolina. And so, as you can imagine, women are up in arms. And here's what I want to say. I don't know how much time we have left.
Go right ahead. You got all the time you need.
What I want to say to you and your audience is there has been a backlash to this. And the Moral Monday movement that you referred to,
mm-hmm.
Dr. William Barber, who's the state president of the NAACP, back in April called for a Moral Monday, and that is a demonstration outside the legislative building. And then inside the legislative building, it was calculated. 19 people were arrested that first Monday. For 13 consecutive Mondays, people have gathered. And it's honestly, I've been to three. The crowds have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, and you now have an arrest on your record.
I do. I was arrested on June 3rd. And the charges were second-degree trespass for being in my own legislative building that I paid for with my taxes. Now, Peter, I don't know how you feel, but it feels like my house.
Mm-hmm.
Our argument is it's the people's house. And the second is failure to obey a command of the Capitol Police chief who asked us to disperse. Now, I understand decorum. I understand getting business done. And we did this knowing, really committing civil disobedience, knowing that we were breaking a house rule, a building rule, and that we would be arrested. And we agreed to that. It was completely nonviolent. Over 900 people now have been arrested.
Mm-hmm.
This is growing. And since the legislature stopped last week, Dr. Barber announced on Monday that since they're running home, we'll run after them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next Moral Monday will be in Asheville this coming Monday, and they're going to be held on Mondays in all 13 congressional districts in North Carolina. And what's happening is a kind of fusion politics. The right has been very successful at times using wedge issues such as abortion, such as homosexuality, same-sex marriage, to divide African Americans, gay straight people, black, white, Latino. But what's happening now is that a fusion movement is galvanizing. They're creating a movement that will not be divided by these wedge issues. And that, I think, gives many of us hope in North Carolina.
Well, Professor, this is actually the main focus of why I wanted you on the program today, because I'm impressed with the Moral Monday movement in North Carolina. And I wanted to bring you on the show to see if we can export that virus beyond your borders.
There you go.
Because while I commend the people of Wisconsin who rose up and attempted to recall Scott Walker,
right.
I commend the people of Ohio who rolled back the right to work law that was imposed.
Right.
But we have seen, you know, on a national basis, the Democratic Party essentially lay down in the face of this aggressive and coordinated agenda from the right. And Michigan is now a right-to-work state and has these draconian abortion regulations in process. And the Democratic Party and the White House have really not addressed this issue. And while we see activism in Texas, I'm frustrated that it seems to be focused on electing Wendy Davis governor. And I'm not opposed to that.
Right.
But between now and then, thousands of women will be denied access to health care up to and including to choose an abortion.
Right.
As Rick Perry burnishes his tawdry image with another, you know, misguided effort to run for president. But the price that is going to be paid is by poor women who will not be able to access the services that they need. And then we as a society will pay for it in the form of unwanted pregnancies and childbirths, sexually transmitted diseases, unaddressed breast cancer, and other things that show up in screenings at women's health clinics. And so the damage is very hard to estimate, but it will be significant. And against that, I see very little activism organized on the part of the Democratic Party. So tell us about the elements here, the NAACP and others, who are coalescing to oppose the right-wing power grab in your state.
This is not as you implied, but I'll state, this is not organized by the Democratic Party.
No, I that's what I realize,
right,
and,
right,
and that's my critique, is that the Democrats are not responding to this obvious threat, even on the election issues, which really play to their self-interest. If you're a Democratic elected official and you see all of these voter suppression tactics being enacted into law, that's a limit on your own future, and they're not even attacking that.
I will say this. About that, there are 27% of the registered voters in North Carolina are unaffiliated. Add to that the browning of America that we have been seeing for the last decade, and the demographers tell us will continue apace, which has meant that we have to. When I say we in America have, and I'm a white guy. Right, I'm a white guy, Caucasian, European American, whatever you want to call me. I'm a white guy from the South, and we have to find a way to talk to one another, work with one another, and act with one another. And I think the number of unaffiliated voters is going to grow. There are Republicans who are disgusted. There are Republicans in North Carolina who are disgusted with what's going on in our state house, and right so. I see letters every day in the Winston-Salem Journal, which isn't a terribly progressive paper. It's a good paper, but it's not terribly progressive. But I see Republicans writing letters about their disgust with the extremist kind of ideological bent of this legislative session, and so I think. I see the number of independent, unaffiliated voters growing, and I believe that, you know, you see on the national news, you know, pundits saying the Republicans have a problem, and that is that they don't really know how to message and respond to this growing, diverse demographic. Well, they do have a problem. I think they do have a problem. But what I'm seeing in North Carolina is that the Democratic Party is going to have to attract unaffiliated voters with a clear message, with a clear program, with assertiveness and leadership. And that's, I think, the challenge of the Democratic Party today.
And may I add one item to your list there?
Sure.
They need
sure.
to put down the polls, because I believe that their response is limited, because they look at the polls and they see abortion rights now as roughly a 50-50 split. And they don't need to do anything more to, grease the base on these issues. They're trying to appeal beyond the Democratic base, and they're looking at those same independent voters. Now, My posit is that to win those independent voters, the Democratic Party should stake out strong positions in favor of women's reproductive health rights, and that many independents will be drawn to the Democratic Party, or at least vote for Democratic candidates, if that is the case. But I think that they're operating in a kind of fear crouch, where they're saying, well, we don't want to rock the boat. If we come out too strongly for a woman's right to choose, we're going to lose, you know, some of those conservative Democrats are going to peel off. And that's where the party, I think, has to stand for something, and then people will be attracted to it. It doesn't really work the other way around. You can't pander to weakness and hope to build a party.
Well, the folks that in my state who took over our legislature, they know what they want. They're willing to put their money where their mouth is. They're willing to put boots on the ground, and they're willing to be aggressive about it. And I don't think you answer that by sort of shrugging your shoulders, throwing up your hands, and not wanting to offend anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So my sense is that there has to be a kind of rebranding beyond the sort of, God, I hate to say this, tired, maybe, complacent. I mean, at least in our state, I mean, if you dominate the state legislature for 100 years, you get a little flabby, if you get my drift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that there wasn't a need for definition, clarity, vision, and there's never been more of a need for it now than now.
Mm-hmm.
Because of what's happened. So you know, I'm a Christian theologian. to sort of put that hat on for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes crises, you know, dark nights of the soul or of the body politic, have a silver lining. And if there's a silver lining, it is that people are realizing that they need one another. One of the thoughts I've had as I've seen this legislation go, I mean, attack, you know, when you say no to Medicaid for 500,000 people, 500,000 people, most of whom are children under the poverty line, many of whom are women, many of whom are seniors. The question I've, you know, had for this legislature is, tell me who in North Carolina we do not need. Could you tell me who we don't need? Of the people who, you know, pick our crops, the people who box them up, the people who truck them to the store, the people who put them on the shelves, the people who are in the, you know, check us out in the checkout line. You know, so when I eat my Wheaties in the morning, there's been a whole line of people. It takes a village to eat breakfast in this country. Which of those people do we not need? Which of those people do we not want to have health care? Do we not want to have a living wage? And if you think you can live without these people, there's going to be a rude awakening, So I think there's, in religious language, we'll call it an apocalypse. Apocalypse is not like a cataclysm. Apocalypse means literally in Greek, to reveal something. I think our dependence on one another is being revealed and will be revealed. That's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to have a politics that takes that and takes each person's contribution seriously and gives them a place at the table to speak. You don't drive them away from the polls. You bring them to the polls.
Well, it's a very interesting dynamic, and since you made the point that the Moral Monday movement is not that closely aligned with the Democratic Party, how is it positioned to reject the extremes of the Republican agenda and then try to put pressure on Democrats to stand up and do the right thing?
If the Democrats don't stand up and do the right thing, they're out of business, at least in this state. I mean, you know, they're just out of business, and I think what we're seeing here is, and I have friends in both parties, and I have friends who are Democrats. I have former students who are Democrats. I have friends who are Republicans. And as I've talked to the folks in the, you know, active in the Democratic Party, they understand that they have to do some rebranding. They have to do some organizing. But there's no choice. There's no choice. If they don't do that, the people they care about and that many of us care about, as you said just moments ago, about the folks who are not going to have access to reproductive health, the people living beyond under the poverty line, et cetera. So, but I will just say about the Moral Monday community, let's call it that, okay? Mm-hmm. Let's just call it that. The Moral Money community is that it's people who are just morally outraged, And we're coming from all over the state. We look different. You ought to see the pictures. We look different. We talk differently. We come from different socioeconomic classes. We had a whole bunch of teachers because teachers are not getting a raise, and they're eliminating 6,800 teacher assistant jobs and 17,000 preschool slots, and they're already 46th in teacher pay in the nation, and they cut the budget $242 million.
Wow.
They're not getting a raise. I mean, and you get nothing for completing a master's degree. You know, you used to get a bump, you know, when you completed a master's degree as a public teacher. Nothing. There is no incentive to, you know, improve yourself as a public education teacher. So it is the most regressive, short-sighted, counterproductive agenda you can imagine.
And, Professor, when I started this email thread that has resulted in our conversation today, in the subject line I put Pleasantville, North Carolina.
I didn't quite understand what you meant by that. Was that irony?
Well, do you know the movie Pleasantville?
Yes. Uh-huh.
That's where these kids walked through their TV and went back to the 1950s.
Right.
And that's what I feel like this is an attempt to do. It's the new dark ages under the, you know, the false notion of some sort of nostalgia and an appeal to extreme philosophies. And the idea is that we can, you know, roll back gang violence and all of the scourges of modern society just by locking women up at home and denying a lot of people the right to vote.
Well, my own thought about that is there are too many people who went through the 60s and 70s who are around. In the 50s, the difference was people had not experienced this revolution, and many of us have experienced that revolution. And it's a kind of, I think, a last gasp of white male control, power. It's a last gasp to hold on to that. And that's my hope. That's my, frankly, that's my, I'm a historian. That's my historical assessment. It reminds me a little bit about the last days of apartheid in South Africa. The regime, the Afrikaners, held on desperately for power, to their power.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, legally, they did it all legally. They passed, you know, passed laws. I mean, they passed legislation. I mean, it was all legal. Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's moral, right? And so they held on desperately, and that's what I see this movement. It's not only in North Carolina. It's a national movement of holding on desperately, but that tide cannot be turned. I live in a state where I love going to the beach, and you want to try to, you want to try to stop the tide? You want to try to stop a tropical storm or a hurricane from cutting an island in two as Topsail Beach was cut into several years ago? Good luck. You're not going to be able to stem that tide. And that's where we are. And those of us who welcome the tide have our work cut out for us.
Stephen Boyd is the John Allen Easley Professor of Religion at Wake Forest University. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, we got the lowdown on Republican efforts to roll back the clock and some exciting protests in response. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.